Okay, let's get started. Is this working, right? Okay, good. Yep, sorry, I was not well last week, so I had to bump the lecture. Fortunately, we have an extra lecture this week, so we can get through all the material. But I'm going to try and do a bit more than I was originally planning for this lecture, so we might go a bit faster. I wanted to finish off what we didn't finish from the previous lecture, which was to do with reporting bugs. You remember this was to do with usability, and one of the important aspects of making systems usable is to make it easy for people to report bugs so that you can improve the system. And as you'll discover, if you become a professional software engineer and have to deal with users' bugs, most people are really, really awful at reporting bugs. And you'll be looking at it and going, you know, what can I do with this? So they've written, it crashed. You know, it doesn't help you, right? So the question is, how do you report a bug? What should you put in a bug report? If you imagine that you're doing an assignment like your operating system's practical or whatever, and you have a problem and you want to get some help with it, so you file a bug report. So what you should be thinking is, what information can I give this person so they've got the best chance of helping me? So so here's a set of possibilities, and let's do a quick clicker thing on this. Here's the code. So the single most important thing to do is keep it concise, no more than 30 lines. Include tediously detailed information about what exactly you did that didn't work. Try and diagnose the problem. Include full information about the operating system, etc., or all of those. So I'm going to start this off and we'll see what people think, which of these is most important. I'll give you to 15. Or thereabouts. Did I want to do that? No, I didn't want to do that. What do I want to do here? I think I need to run that again, since I obviously don't know how to use this. Oh, I need to use this button. There we go. Okay, I'm going to stop it here. Right, so most people have got this right. All of those kinds of information are important. Now you might want to, of these kinds of information, keeping it concise, that's a good idea. It's not critically important, but that's a good idea. Include tediously detailed information, that's an excellent thing to do. Because you don't actually know what it is that the person who's debugging this thing needs to know about what you did. So you pretty much just have to write down everything you can think of that you did. Make an intelligent attempt at diagnosing the problem. That's really optional, because most of the time you won't be able to make an intelligent attempt. But if harm in adding that. Full information about operating system, that's critical, because many bugs will show up on one operating system or one browser or one version of the JVM and not on others. And if you don't tell the software engineers what that is, then they have to check it on every browser, every JVM, then they're just not going to do it. So the more the better, basically. But the information about the system and exactly what you did are the most important. Okay, let's go on, see if I can get rid of this. So the first thing you should do when you come across a bug is stop doing anything else. Don't do it anymore, because you want to compose your bug report right away while stuff's fresh in your memory. you can remember exactly what you did. So as it says here, you need to tell people exactly what went wrong, what you typed, what you clicked, what messages showed up, and not try not to you know, cut out things that you think aren't important, because as I say, as a user, you probably don't know what is going to be important. Okay, so you can read more about this, and you should read the this link on how to report bugs effectively to get a bit more detail on this. And there's some more suggestive reading that you can look at if you want. Okay, so let's leave that and go on to next topic, which we're going to look at, which is non-functional requirements. So these are all the things that are they're known as the ITIs. So flexibility, maintainability, reusability, portability, these sorts of things. They're things like things that the system must do or not do, so things to do with security, integrity. So you can see these are all different kinds of ITIs. And then properties of the system that we've talked about quite a bit before, like dependability and reliability, robustness, performance, efficiency, and so on. So there are, you know, a lot of these. This isn't an exhaustive list. And some of these will be relevant in some situations, and some of them will be, others will be relevant in other situations. Scalability, for example, is one that, you know, some systems don't have to be scalable because you know that they're only ever going to be used by 100 people. But other systems, of course, you know, that's going to be important. So in the development process, these non-functional requirements have to be, identified along with the functional requirements. So they're the sort of thing that if you identify them too late, then they can really completely screw up the project because they're often related to architecture. So as an example, if you choose the AppFuse framework for your system, which is what a framework that that is in quite widespread use, then that locks you into the security model that AppFuse offers. So if you pick AppFuse and then you find out later that the security that you need isn't supported by AppFuse's security model, too late. You're not going to go back and redo the whole thing in a different framework. So you need these at the beginning. And they can be difficult to really document and nail down because you want to quantify them in some way, and that's not necessarily easy. But there are various kind of metrics that have been generated for these different sorts of non-functional requirements. Scalability, for example. So scalability as an example, you would look at, does the, for example, the response time of a system scale, if it was to scale, say, linearly with the number of users, you know, is that something that you would think would be acceptable? So as more users join the system, the response time goes up. Generally speaking, that's not going to be a good idea, right? So you would want then a constant response time, independent of the number of users. In other sorts of systems, you might find that the scalability is such that a linear increase in some measure is acceptable, but a quadratic increase is not. So we'll look in detail in a bit later at reliability metrics. But generally, metrics have to be measurable, so it's not just an opinion. It's something that you can somehow get a number on. They also need to be something that's independent, so it's not something that can be altered without altering something that we care about. And they also need to be accountable. So managers need to be able to explain why this metric is relevant for this particular non-functional requirement and why a particular value of the metric is suitable for this system. And the more precise they can be, the better. Sometimes they, they're not going to be as precise as you would like. And sometimes there can be a trade-off between things like precision and, measurability. So it might be that in practice, you could develop a very precise metric, but you can't actually measure it very well. Whereas there's something else that you can measure very well that is slightly less precise in terms of a metric as a metric. So there can be some trade-offs in choices here. So let's look at reliability. And that's something that is important for many systems. So let's look at some of the metrics that are used for that. So there's this one, that's a P up there, that first letter. So it stands for probability of failure on demand. So that's the probability that the system's going to fail at the time that you need it to work. And that's useful, that's basically a good measure if the system that you're looking at is something that mostly isn't needed. So it's sort of infrequently needed. So an emergency or a safety kind of system. So as an example, emergency shutdown in a nuclear power plant, you would hope never to have to need it, but when you do, you want a very high confidence that it's going to work, it's not going to fail. So as an example, one of the more recent nuclear power stations, well, it's been around for a while now, but they specified a, as you see here, 0.0001 probability of failure when it was needed, and they actually achieved 0.001. So you can see they wanted a 1 in 10,000 probability of failure, and they actually only achieved a 1 in 1,000, which to me doesn't sound good enough for a nuclear power plant, personally. 1 in 1,000. You only need 1,000 nuclear power plants, and you're going to expect one of them is going to blow up. So these can be very difficult to evaluate. How do you evaluate when a system like that is going to fail or not? So you can simulate. That's one way. And doing a real life test is extremely difficult or impossible. So it can be quite expensive to evaluate these things and convince yourself that the number that you've got is good. So another measure is ROCOF, which stands for rate of occurrence of failure. And it's the number, as it says here, per unit time of failures, as in unexpected behavior. And time can be measured as actual time, or it can be the processing time for a particular kind of transaction, or the number of transactions, and so on. So this is mainly used for systems that have a kind of a repeated service, where you want to know what's the probability of if this thing's being repeated many times, what's the probability that you're going to lose one, or what's the rate at which you fail. So banking systems, you probably think banking systems don't ever fail because it's people's money, but of course they do. And so as an example, VisaNet, which processes any Visa card transactions, processes around, 100 million transactions a day. I think it's up to about 150 million a day now. And the failure rate isn't published, but there have been estimates of it. And it's probably, as it says here, much less than 10 to the minus 5 failures per transaction. So if you take those two numbers, 10 to the minus 5 failures per transaction, 10 to the 8th transactions, that means in a day, there are 10 to the 3, that's 1,000 failed transactions, which sounds like quite a lot. But it depends on what the failure is. If the failure is the credit card is denied when it should have been accepted, that's sort of an acceptable failure. I mean, it's annoying, but if the failure is the wrong amount of money was deducted, you know, that's more significant. So you probably want to actually have different separate measures for the different kinds of failures. There's another measure, MTTF, mean time to failure. It's the average time between successive failures, and you often see that on things like hardware. You know, for example, what's the mean time to failure for a hard disk? It's a statistic that's published for a lot of hardware components. So you can think about these things, and one question you might like to ask yourself is, what's the difference between mean time to failure, so that's the average time between successive failures, and the probability per unit time of failure? Does anyone want to have a guess what the relationship is between those? It's not immediately obvious, although you probably are looking at it and thinking, well, there probably is a relationship, because they're both to do with sort of the rate at which things are failing in some way. Yeah?
Well, the greater probability, the less the mean time to the next failure.
Right, so they're somehow inversely sort of related to each other. So in fact, they are. One's the inverse of the other, if assuming you're using the same measure of time. So here's a slightly more interesting one. If you buy a hard drive for your, you know, for your PC with a mean time to failure of 5 years, when do you expect to replace it?
1 year.
1 year, why? Yeah, okay. So you're substituting experience for this published mean time to failure. That's kind of cheating. So assuming this was the only information you had and you'd never, when would you expect to replace it? Well, it's pretty straightforward. You'd expect to replace it in 5 years. That's the mean time, that's the average time to failure. You know, some of them might last 6 or 7 years, some of them might last 2 or 3. But you'd expect to replace it in 5 years. A slightly more interesting question would be, you know, if the, let's say this was, it wasn't just the piece, the disk on your PC, but let's say it was some really important piece of equipment that you wanted to keep, you know, to keep going. So you wanted an estimate of when should you buy a replacement disk and install it, so that you've got a high probability that you're never actually going to suffer a disk failure. So if you pick the mean time to failure, right, if you buy a disk after 5 years, you know, half the disks you buy are going to fail before you get to your 5 years, right? And half of them, that's the definition, it's the average. Well, that's the definition of median, but in this case, they're both the same. So actually picking 5 years is not a prudent thing for that kind of situation. How would you determine what would be a better number to pick if you wanted to sort of reliably know that you were never going to suffer a disk failure?
Get a RAID system,
right. Yeah, okay, that's cheating too. So the problem with this measure is that you can't actually answer that question, because all you know is what the mean time to failure is. If you think about probability distributions, this is a bit of a digression, but it's a really important point generally. If this is a normal distribution, so this is, and things like failures and hardware components are often follow this kind of distribution. So if we look at the red one for the moment, if this is the mean time to failure, so if time goes along here, And this is the mean time to failure. So let's say this was 5. This point, it's actually labeled 0, but say it was 5. That would be the mean time to failure. So what you can see from that is that if that was 4 years, let's say, and that was 3 years, you can see that if you bought a disk after and replaced after 4 years, then you've only got this much probability that you're gonna you know, suffer a disk failure, right? But if it turns out that this distribution for these disks looks like this, with the same mean, then you've got a much fatter, a much bigger probability you're going to fail. So with that mean time to failure, it's a perfectly fine piece of information, but it doesn't let you answer this question. And in these kind of probability distributions, there's a measure of how fat or peaked this kind of normal distribution is, which is the standard deviation. And so some of you will, this will be, you know, kind of very familiar, and some of you may not have seen it. So the bigger the standard deviation, the fatter the distribution. And it's very easy to remember that if you go two standard deviations away from the mean, then you've got, 34 plus 13.6. If you add these up, the two standard deviations covers about 95% of the curve. So if you go two standard deviations away, you've only got a 5% chance of being outside that. And in this case, you've only got about a 2.5% chance of being sort of early. So if you knew the standard deviation, you could pick two standard deviations earlier than the mean, and then you'd know you've only got a 2.5% chance of actually suffering a failure. So the point of this is that mean time to failure is a good statistic, but it's nowhere near enough to make a lot of the decisions that you might want to have. Okay, so back to metrics. Availability is the last one of these we're going to look at. So that's the proportion of the time the system's available for use. And that's often quoted as the number of nines, as in 0.99999 means that you've only got, one in 10,000. Is it 10,000? One in 100,000. Yeah, one in 100. So if it ran for 100,000 days, you'd expect in those 100,000 days to have only, in total, suffered one day's worth of downtime. And that's obviously more appropriate for systems that are offering some sort of continuous service. So, for example, if you rent, computing time on an ISP, then they will quote the availability as the amount of time proportion of time that the system is guaranteed to be available. So you could think about what's the difference between availability and the rate of failure, of occurrence of failure. So this is a question from a previous exam that was related to this. If an aircraft have to make an emergency landing, they usually dump fuel first to reduce the risk of fire. You're writing the non-functional requirements for the part of the control system that controls the pumps that dump the fuel. So what reliability metric would you use? Number two, probability of failure on demand, because this is one of the ones that you almost never need to use, and when you do, you really want to be sure it's going to work. Okay, so that's all I want to say about metrics. Let's go on and look at a bit of security, and hope we can get through this. So I'm not going to say very much about security. It's obviously a very important topic, and if it's something that you have an interest in, or you'd like to, by the time you leave the university, you feel like you've got a pretty good understanding of security issues, then you should take the course next year on computer security. So we're not going to look at many of the topics, encryption or operating system exploits or anything like that. We're just going to look at high-level definitions, and we'll look a little bit at some programming practices in normal application software. So this is just a very small part of the whole security domain. So it's a security, again, is another kind of non-functional requirement, and it can include many different aspects. So for example, confidentiality, so that information isn't leaked to parties that are not allowed to have it. So for example, phone hacking. Integrity, information, you know, can't be tampered with, it can't be changed. Authentication means that if the system supports authentication, then it can prove that people can prove who they are, and that will give them access to only the things they're allowed to see. Authorization controls whether people can do what people can do. And non-repudiability is an interesting one. This is that agreements that have been made can't be denied later. So this is for systems that support some kind of contract. For example, financial systems that allow people to trade stocks, or the software that you, the systems that support interaction with your bank. So all of these can be compromised and by things like denial of service attacks, and these can all be the result of security failures. And it's easy to not take this stuff too seriously, especially if the systems you use are in an institution like in informatics, where we have extremely good firewalls around our systems. But if you you plug your laptop or your PC in at home into your broadband router, and you're on the internet, and you didn't really have to think about security very much. Maybe you did, but a lot of people don't, and mostly that's okay because the router's got actually got a firewall built into it, and it's just configured automatically to keep most stuff out. But if you actually plug a machine into the internet with no firewall between it and the internet, you'll find that within 10 seconds, if not a few seconds, it's getting pinged with all sorts of requests from all sorts of bizarre places to do all sorts of weird things. And there are a lot of people out there who are have robots out there that are just continually scanning for holes. So our firewall logs several hundred thousand probes a day of people who are trying to get in. And some aspects of security are required. So the Data Protection Act means that if you collect private data, And the kind of example where you might find yourself doing this without even sort of really realizing who you are, is if you set up let's say you're part of a student society that is interested in hill walking or something like that, so you start collecting people's email addresses for people who are interested in finding other people who want to go hill walking, or they want to be notified about trips away or something like that. The minute you start collecting that sort of information as part of an organized activity, then you're subject to, or potentially subject to, the Data Protection Act, which means that you have to look after that kind of private information in a responsible manner. Small things like student societies and so on, people don't really worry about this too much because, nobody's going to be trying to steal that data if it's something small. But think when things start getting larger, it does become a problem. And if you're part of anything like an institution like the University of Edinburgh, then, the university does take these things seriously. So a typical kind of attack is a machine is going to, run some publicly accessible service. And what that means is that if it's a publicly accessible service, it means that any machine from elsewhere on the internet should be able to contact that service in some way, or at least any machine that that you know you want to allow. So the firewalls can be configured in a variety of ways. But what happens is, assuming the attacker can actually get to this service, which they probably can if it's publicly available, then they can send messages that look like the kind of message that this particular service would expect, but they're carefully constructed so that they're going to mess things up. And an example is a very long message, much longer than would normally be the case. And so this, in this case, sent to something like SSHD, which is the daemon that controls when you SSH into a machine. It's the SSH daemon that, that does the negotiation with your client computer. So it's expecting messages, and you have a a nefarious SSH that is sending very long strings. And if the SSH daemon isn't checking those strings, isn't checking, for example, that they're not too long, or that they don't contain characters that are illegal, then if the input is too long, if the program isn't checking, then it will write the input into the input buffer, and then it keeps writing because the message is longer, and so you get stuff written into beyond the input buffer, and who knows what's there. And if it's very carefully crafted, then people, the attacker, will know what part of the program or what part of the data is there. And so the input buffer then overflows, the string overflows into the program code or the stack or somewhere else that they've predetermined. And they then have their code being executed by the SSH daemon, which runs in a privileged manner, as it has to. And that means, you know, the machine's history, basically. It can be very difficult to clean up messes that happen like that, because it's very hard to track down what a compromised machine has done. So, yeah, there's different kinds of attackers. I mean, they may be somebody who's actually authorized, but they're trying to do things that they shouldn't be able to do, or they may be they're, you know, just not even authorized. So there's a set of guidelines about different types of security weaknesses that come up in software. And this is called the Common Weakness Enumeration. So this is an annual report that discusses what are the most common security weaknesses that they've come across in the last year, and it's compiled by a very large survey. And the monster mitigations are high-level principles about how to make sure that your system is not subject to these weaknesses. So these are the monster mitigations. Establish and maintain control over all your inputs. So that's that example of the SSH daemon. It's getting this input that's a string that's longer than it expected. If it followed this principle, establish and maintain control over all your inputs, it wouldn't have let the string overflow into the program code. It would have measured the length of the input string before it started writing it into a buffer. Establish and maintain control over all your outputs, so that's a similar sort of thing on the other way. Lock down your environment. You should assume that any external component can be subverted and your code can be read by anyone. So your code being read by anyone means that the attacker can work out the structure of your program and can, you know, therefore reason what will happen if they manage to get something into a place that they shouldn't be able to. And use industry accepted security features instead of inventing your own. So we'll look at a few of these in a little more detail. So the first one, establish and maintain control over all your inputs. So you basically what you need to do is validate the input. You need to be able to deal with input of any length. are any kind of binary bytes coming in? So you may want to throw away most, you know, all of them except for a small range. It's a good idea to check for specific escape characters depending on the protocol that you're dealing with. If it's numerical data, make sure that it's in the range that you expect and you know, invalidate it if it isn't. And it's something like a URL or a file name that is essentially going to, your program is then going to use that to access something somewhere else. You better make sure that it's a valid address, whether it's a file name or a URL. And if your program, this is the point where outputs go on, if your program is going to pass that on as an output to somebody else, then if you don't check that it's an appropriate value, then when you pass it on, you're essentially passing on you know, bad information, which you don't want to do. Also check cookies, so cookies that are sent. And ideally, you only ever put in cookies encrypted information, although that's almost never, you know, most people don't follow that, but ideally that's what should be done. So validity checking isn't easy. There are libraries that will help with that. And sometimes you have to handle input that's basically a program. So for example, if you're reading HTML, if it's got JavaScript in it, that's a program. And as we know, you know, you can't, in general, determine what a program's going to do, right? It's the undecidability problem. And so it's actually quite hard to deal with that, which is why quite a lot of systems, you know, web applications and so on that will let you put HTML in, they won't accept any JavaScript, because they can't control what your JavaScript's going to do. So you need to do complete mediation. So in other words, you validate data, but make sure there's no backdoor. And don't share data so that it can't be, essentially so that it can't be intercepted. So the classic attack that I talked about earlier, if you check the buffer length, then that would not be a problem. And in Java, that can't happen because Java has runtime checks against that sort of thing built into the language. If you're using C libraries, then that's not necessarily the case. And of course, a Java program may use C libraries. So you do need to know what's going on in your application. The second mitigation, establish and maintain control over all your outputs. So I already talked about this. So this is an example of a little bit of HTML from here. So here we're saying get a parameter that will have been encoded in the URL string, get the parameter that's named email, and then we just print that out to the user's screen as the email address. But you know, it's easy enough to type something into a URL string. You can type anything you like. So basically, if you had a web page that was doing this, it would display on the user's browser whatever junk somebody had typed in to the URL string, which of course could include things like JavaScript and so on. The third one was locking down your environment, and that's more relevant to people administering systems than programmers, but some of you will probably go on and become system administrators. And you know, locking down the environment is something that we, you know, users of systems tend to hate because it stops us doing what we want to do. You know, like we'd all love to have root access to our DICE machine so we could just install stuff when we needed it. But unfortunately, you know, that would totally compromise things. So don't give people privileges unless they need them, and don't allow programs to run with higher privileges than they need. Make sure that error messages are not giving away information that you don't want to give away. And you know, use the capabilities in the language to check where you can. And of course, keep up to date with security patches. So those are all good things to do. The fourth one was assuming that external components can be subverted and your code can be read by anyone. So that has some consequences. Don't rely on security by obscurity. In other words, just because nobody knows the URL to get to some web service that you're offering, it doesn't mean that they won't find it. So you can't rely on the fact that you haven't published the URL for this web service. You can't say, well, I haven't published it, I've only given it to my friends, so I don't have to worry about that web service being secure. Not a good idea. And the more extreme form of this is to basically make everything public, what you do. So, and you keep the security mechanism public. And public key encryption is an example of that sort of thing. So in public key encryption, everybody knows what the security mechanism is, what the algorithms are. Everybody knows what the public keys are. And you're keeping everything public. That isn't the one little bit of information that needs to be kept private for security. If you're writing a server, don't depend on the clients to do the right thing, even if you're writing the client. Because the fact that you're writing the client now doesn't mean that someone else might not write a client later. Assume the worst, essentially. And it's always a good idea to use industry standard security features. If you try and write security algorithms yourself, you're almost guaranteed to make mistakes and have flaws, and it'll get compromised. And you know, lots of people have experienced this. And of course, even the standard well-trusted algorithms, every now and then, somebody discovers a flaw in one of those. And I've talked about race conditions before. So you know, a race condition is when two or more things are happening independently, and depending on the order in which they happen, different things can occur. So one of the consequences of multitasking is that you can't assume that anything about what's happened between two lines in your program, or even between two, it doesn't matter about lines really, but two actual actions in your program. So if you have two method calls, let's say you're doing a method call to check one thing and a method call to check another thing, and you're anding the two together, anything may have happened between the first method call and the second method call. Absolutely anything. So one of the most common things that people do is they'll do something like write a value or create a file or something like that in one line of their code, and then in the next line they'll assume that that value is the same or that that file hasn't been changed. But you can't assume that. So you can't create a file and then protect it, because an attacker may have already attacked it by the time you get around to protecting. So you have to, when you create it, it has to be created in a safe state. And actually, the most common way of people breaking into systems has got nothing to do with any of this technical stuff, although as important as this technical stuff is, it's social engineering. It's, people being careless or being tricked into giving away their passwords or information that will lead people to know what their passwords are. And I can give you an example of this. not specifically to do with you know, getting people's passwords, but getting confidential data. So I called up, I have an 18-year-old son, and in Scotland, people become adults when they're 16. So he was already 2 years into adulthood. So when a child reaches 16, parents are no longer allowed to get information about them without their permission, which might sound a bit odd to many of you, but it's the same is true in England, for example. When children reach 18, then they're adults. And you know, your parents are not allowed to call up your doctor and get your medical information, right, without your permission, and as they should not be allowed to do that. So you know, I call up my son's doctor, who's you know also my doctor, and said, you know, I'm so and so's father, you know, I need to get his you know, blood test results or whatever it was, and they just gave it to me over the phone. You know? Crazy. You know, what they should have done was they should have said, is he there? Can I speak to him? Get permission. You know, if I called up a bank, when I call up the bank and say, you know, something about what my wife's done with the, or what she needs to do with you know, some bank account, they won't talk to me, you know, and without her on the phone. But, you know, medical data. Anyway, this is the sort of thing that it's very easy. And, you know, you should always be very suspicious about people who you don't know trying to get this kind of information. Okay. All right, I'm not going to get on to ethics. Okay, so we'll do ethics next time. And there's some suggested reading about this, but no required reading. Yeah, so next time we'll go over, we'll do a short piece on ethics, and then there's some important stuff about licensing and intellectual property, and then a quick wrap-up.
Yeah. Let's go. Isn't that like the, yeah. Yeah.